From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Suspend your disbelief because the WNBA handed down 11 suspensions just before the league suspends the season to accommodate the Olympics. Now that's suspense. Ahead on Only a Game, Donnybrook's indiscipline before the WNBA deadline. Also, a former Olympic hopeful shatters records as a Masters swimmer. A conversation with USA Track and Field's new CEO and with two members of the Baseball Project about their new CD, Frozen Ropes and Dying Quail. Also ahead, the joy of competition with renegade librarians on wheels.
We give it away for free.
I heard, but for 2 weeks or 3 weeks at a time, I've heard.
And you can renew whenever you'd like.
Whoa, stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Earlier this month, Doug Logan became the new CEO of USA Track and Field and announced that his top priority was to speak out against doping in the sport. He got his chance this week when it was learned that Marion Jones has petitioned President Bush to commute her 6-month prison sentence for lying to federal investigators about her steroid use and for involvement in a check fraud scam. Doug Logan joins me now on the line from Denver. Mr. Logan, welcome to Only a Game.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. What was your first reaction when you heard that Marion Jones was one of the hundreds of convicted felons who have petitioned President Bush for pardons or to have their sentences reduced?
Well, you know, I think I, like many fans, felt pretty disappointed. I mean, we were among the legions of people that had given Marion the benefit of the doubt when she said that she had never tested positive, had given her the benefit of the doubt when she challenged the testing procedures. When she ultimately admitted to all the things that she had done, I really felt let down. So when I heard about it, I was more than a bit outraged about it, and I thought it was appropriate, given the platform that I now I'm standing on, to voice the kind of reaction that I think that most track and field fans have.
Well, you not only voiced your reaction, you wrote a letter to President Bush asking him not to derail efforts to restore track and field's reputation by reducing Ms. Jones' sentence. Why is it important for fans of the sport to see dopers like Marion Jones punished for what they've done?
I think it's important, first of all, from the standpoint of the gravity of what they're doing. It's cheating. It's out-and-out cheating, and it's breaking the law to cheat. And it's a horrible problem that those of us that are placed in a position of responsibility of administering the sport have to keep our eyes on. Thousands and millions of fans are just outraged by what's going on, and I think that they need to start expressing that and expressing that in a rather loud way.
You also started a good old-fashioned letter-writing campaign asking others to join you in writing to President Bush. Have you gotten any feedback on how that's going?
I think it's going very well. You know, we've gotten copies of a lot of the letters that have been sent. My brand new voicemail box is full to the brim. Unfortunately, I think that in the last 7 or 8 years, the use of steroids for many has been dealt with cavalierly, almost as though it's a minor offense. It's not minor at all. It's depriving wonderful young men and young women who participate and who compete clean. It's cheating them out of an opportunity of success, and it's setting a horrible example for youngsters in this country, and I think we have to start becoming a little more passionate about our outrage for it.
On the eve of the Olympics in Beijing, how damaged is the reputation of track and field?
Well, you know, I think that all sports, and some sports maybe more than others, but all sports have felt this stigma. If left unchecked, at least in track and field, this problem will choke the life out of the sport. It's been a problem. We have to recognize it. We can't be defensive. We can't hide it. We've done a lot with regard to testing and sanctioning and disciplining. We need to do more, and we need to be more vocal about it.
You were previously the commissioner of Major League Soccer, another sport that some might say hasn't quite broken through on the American landscape. How is the challenge of promoting track and field different from promoting soccer in this country?
I challenge those who say that soccer is not broken through. I challenge those who say that track and field is not an important sport in the smorgasbord table of American sporting life. I think that one of the challenges that at least I had or in the early years of Major League Soccer is that for a generation of Americans who are not linked to soccer or football ethnically, it's viewed as a foreign sport. That being said, I think that track and field is ubiquitous. You know, everybody has run a race. There is no one on the face of the planet that has not tried to beat his older brother or little sister in a race. There's no one that hasn't tried to outjump a creek or a curb or whatever it may be. Everyone has experienced the sport, and it's very understandable. There are no strange rules. It's, you know, get there first, you know, throw it furthest, jump the highest or the longest. I mean, you know, and it's no more complicated than that. So we have a good product to go out there and tell our story about. We intend to do that.
All right, this last question may not be entirely fair because you are new to the top position at track and field. You have said that the Olympic trials were the start to your Track 101 course, but what athletes are you going to keep a close eye on in Beijing next month?
All of them. You're not going to get me to play favorites at this point in time. My plans are to go over to Beijing right around opening ceremonies, and then I'm going down to the training camp, because our athletes are participating mostly in the second week. And I'm going to meet each one of them. I'm going to shake each one of their hands. I'm going to plan to eat a meal or two with them in the training camp and then head on to Beijing to hopefully witness a glorious week for the sport and a glorious week for the American team.
Doug Logan is the new CEO of U.S. Track and Field. Mr. Logan, thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome, Bill, anytime.
High school swimming phenom Sue Walsh qualified for the 1980 U.S. Olympic team, but America's boycott of the Moscow Games meant she would never compete at the highest level of her sport. 11 college titles, 3 kids, and more than 2 decades later, Walsh started swimming again. She reclaimed some of her former glory last August at the 2007 U.S. Masters Swimming Championships, where she set 6 world records. Rachel McCarthy produced this profile of Sue Walsh.
I'm Sue Walsh, and do I really have to tell you my age? I'm 46. And I guess it was about the age of 13, 14 when I realized I might have some potential. I made junior nationals and actually won as a 14-year-old in the 100-yard freestyle, and it was in 1976, which was an Olympic year. I'm getting goosebumps now thinking about it because you watch the swimmers do well and get up on the award stand and hear the national anthem being played. And I think that's where you get that picture of that's what I want to do someday. That's the position I want to be in.
My name is Shelby Stankavage. I'm 16 years old and Sue Walsh is my mom. Recently, I wrote a research paper on my mom. Walsh was a senior in high school at the time of the 1980 Olympic Games. She doubled up on her classes her fall semester in high school so she could graduate early in an effort to focus on training for the Olympics. When Walsh heard the news, she was devastated.
I remember that exact moment in January sitting in front of the TV at my parents' house and watching the president make the announcement that the U.S. would be boycotting and just sitting there almost in disbelief.
That with Soviet invading forces in Afghanistan, neither the American people nor I will support sending an Olympic team to Moscow.
Of course I was disappointed. At 17, I didn't understand why that decision was made, how they really thought it was going to impact anything, and sat there and thought, wow, I missed my graduation, I missed my prom, and why? So that was tough, but swimming as a, in particular as a collegiate athlete, it was a big part of who I was, and people be like, oh, there's Sue Walsh the swimmer. You know, those two things, Sue Walsh and swimmer, always were put together.
Walsh would be a senior in college when the 1984 Olympics rolled around and soon realized just what an impact the 1980 Games had on her dreams.
Here I was a senior in college. This is pretty much going to be my last chance of making the team because at the time you pretty much would retire after you finished your college career. So I think just having that added pressure was difficult for me because I knew this was it. All of my training, everything had to be, you know, focused on this one meet. And I was the American record holder. I had won the NCAA titles, and so I was the one that everybody was looking at to beat.
At the 1984 Olympic trials, Walsh developed a sinus infection and placed third in her best event.
Apparently, I was winning through a good portion of the race. And then the last, I guess, maybe 15 meters or so, I started to really tire, and I saw the flags and dove for the wall as best as you can when you're doing backstroke. Turned around, looked up at the scoreboard, and saw that I had gotten third in the 100 freestyle by a hundredth of a second.
Her dream was crushed.
And I just wanted to throw up at that point. And I just do remember the two people who beat me having to go and be tested for drugs. Just, you know, they were doing that for all of the people that had made the team. And actually, I was asked to be drug tested, and that was like almost insulting. You know, I have to actually sit around here and just bemoan the fact that I'm not on the team. And I think that was the hardest part about the 1980 boycott, was that now I had no chance. I mean, that was it. And unfortunately, you know, I had to go home where other people were then going on to Los Angeles to compete.
There's one more country to enter the stadium.
United States of America.
And here they come. Pride in yourself, pride in your country. There it is.
That was a thorn in my side, the one thing that I haven't accomplished. But after a number of years, I think the emotions, I guess, got less. It took a while. But then as I had children and watching them swim, I just really missed that point where you can kind of prove yourself. But I forgot the fact that training goes with competing. And so the first few weeks, if not year, was a struggle. And that was around the 2003-2004 period. And I guess I've been training for about 2 months, and my chest started hurting. And so I tried to get out of the water and walk it off. It didn't get any better. And I kind of joked to the coach. I said, well, if I don't come out of the locker room anytime soon, come and get me. They did some tests and said, we need to keep you because we think you've had a heart attack. And so I, you know, had to spend 2 weeks just kind of swimming 500 yards, very easy. It was very, very difficult for me to kind of pull back. And I really, at points, was questioning my decision to get back in it, because it was really a lot of work. Went to my first competition, and I was as nervous as I was as an 8-year-old. And I thought, okay, I'm 40-something. I'm not supposed to be getting nervous over a swimming race. But thus far, in just about every meet, I've been able to get, you know, at least a little bit faster.
And look at lane number 4, Susan Walsh from North Carolina. She'll touch first, 24.00. 24.00 for Susan Walsh. That's a new national record for 45 and 49.
You cannot get any closer to 23.9 than 24.00.
She texts me and goes, I wanted to break 24, but I went 24.00. Darn. Most people would be ecstatic for making an American record.
When I was in college, I went a 22.9, so a little over a second off. But I, you know, gosh, I figure after having 3 children, that's not bad.
Sue Walsh may compete again in August, but for now, she's promised her kids that she'll remain at their North Carolina home to cheer for the U.S. Olympic swim team as it goes for the gold in Beijing. If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Your opponent snatches the ball right in front of your nose, but you are stuck in the mass of dung and cannot move at all. That's how Tula Brock described her frustration during soccer's Swamp World Cup, the 10th edition of which was recently contested in northern Finland. In an attempt to gain an advantage in the game, observers described as chaotic and largely uncontrolled, players covered their shoes with duct tape. Some of the men involved wore wigs and dresses, though what sort of competitive advantage that might have provided remains muddy. Sputnik, a team from Russia, beat Finland in the final 1-0 on a pitch said to have contained fewer branches and tree stumps than ever before. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, a new CD of baseball music swings for the fences. But first, just as you've gotten used to the fact that the WNBA is in session again, the league's about to suspend play so a lot of players can go to China for the Olympics. In all, 20 WNBA players will be in Beijing representing 5 countries. 10 more former players are on the rosters of Australia, Belarus, Brazil, Mali, Russia, and Spain. Joining me now on the line to discuss the suspension of play, the suspension of players, and the resulting suspension of disbelief is Clay Callum of Full Court Press. Clay, welcome back to Only a Game.
Oh, it's always good to be here, and boy, we've got a lot to talk about today.
Oh, yes, and some I wish we didn't. One WNBA assistant coach and 10 members of the Los Angeles Sparks and Detroit Shock are probably wishing the Olympic break had begun on Monday. On Tuesday night, the game between those teams turned into a brawl. How do you apportion responsibility and blame for that ruckus, Clay?
Well, I think it really starts with the much bigger picture of women's basketball in general. Basketball at higher levels is a very physical game. And to be successful, you have to be physical. The Bad Boys of Detroit that Rick Mahorn and Bill Laimbeer both played for really established that physicality is a way to not only win games, but dominate your opponents. And in the women's game, it's the same way. Every level you go up, it has to be more physical. Players have to be more physical because that's the nature of the sport. You have bigger, stronger, faster women playing for lots of money. Not NBA money, but still, you make $500,000 a year. To me, that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot at stake here. And one of the best ways to win basketball games is to be physical.
Of course, there is a difference between being physical and tripping up the person you've just banged into while rebounding.
Oh, absolutely. No question that people went over the line. I think Candace Parker tried to throw Plinette Pearson to the ground on that the missed attempt of the free throw. Pearson responded, overreacted, and then, again, Detroit plays like the old Detroit Pistons, the old Bad Boys. They always have a swagger. And that's what happened. The swagger went over the line, and now you've got suspensions, and both teams lose last night. Important games for both teams because they were undermanned.
Detroit Cheryl Ford was injured in that Donnybrook. She'll miss the rest of the year, but the Shock subsequently signed Nancy Lieberman, who had no points, 2 turnovers, and 2 assists when she played her first and perhaps only game on Thursday night. Can a 50-year-old basketball analyst make up for a loss of an all-star forward like Ford?
No. Just one thing about Cheryl Ford. She actually tore her ACL a few minutes earlier, and that is typical of ACL injuries, that the injury occurs, it then feels okay, the player goes back on the court, and then all of a sudden the next twist, the final blow, takes place. As for Lieberman, it's a publicity stunt. I mean, she can't play at this level. No 50-year-old can. She's one of the greatest players of all time. But to me, it's really a shame because it denied an opportunity to a younger player who's worked very hard to get the opportunity to play in the WNBA.
Detroit and Los Angeles, by the way, will be among the teams with the best records when the league suspends activity on Monday. What's the likelihood that these two teams meet up again for the championship?
I think it's very good. I think there's a very, very strong possibility that ABC and ESPN will be able to roll that bit of tape, 300, 400 times during the playoffs. San Antonio's playing very well. They certainly have a chance to go all the way. It's very, very close. It's a very balanced league. And again, I think that's one of the reasons for this intensity is that every game really counts in this league.
The U.S. Olympic team is made up of 12 WNBA players. No college players need apply this time. How well will these women play together, especially the 3 members of the L.A. Sparks and the 1 member of the Detroit Shock?
I don't think there'll be any problem at all with that. Anyone who's been in any kind of athletic competition knows that tempers flare and people get pushed and things happen. The real instigators aren't there. I don't think that's going to be an issue at all in terms of them, that particular group playing together. There will be issues, of course, on the court because it's not going to be easy in Beijing.
Meanwhile, Becky Hammon will be playing for Russia, as will 1 former WNBA player who's an actual Russian, Maria Stepanova. Australia will have 5 former WNBA players, as well as Tully Bevilacqua of the Indiana Fever and Lauren Jackson of the Seattle Storm on their roster. Is either of these teams strong enough to give the U.S. team a hard time?
Oh, absolutely. Australia, after all, won the World Championship in 2006. Russia defeated the United States in the World Championships in 2006. But, yes, it's going to be very, very much a challenge. It's certainly a possible scenario that in the medal round, Becky Hammon will step up to hit a big shot that might send the United States home, or if she misses, might send the Russians home. So it's going to be a very, very interesting sequence of events in Beijing.
Let's get back to the league, Clay. WNBA play will resume on August 28th. Does a month off help or hurt one team any more than another?
I don't really think so. I was in Sacramento a couple of nights ago, and the Monarchs are playing very, very well, and I talked to them in the locker room, and the players were saying that, yeah, we don't really want to lose our momentum, but, man, we need the time off. And I think that's pretty much true for every team, is that the time off will be very, very valuable. These women play year-round because the money is made in Europe. Mm-hmm. So having a month off for, let's look at Seattle, veterans like Yolanda Griffith and Cheryl Swoops, is just an incalculable advantage for them.
Clay Callum covers the WNBA's bench-clearing brawls for Full Court Press. Clay, thanks very much for joining me.
Oh, always a pleasure, Bill.
At least since 1908, when Katie Casey first tugged on her boyfriend's sleeve and urged him to take her out to the ball game, there has been no lack of music connected to baseball. Recent anthologies and collections of Diamond Ditties suggest a tolerance for repetition and cliché, but Frozen Ropes and Dying Quails, a new CD by the quartet of notable musicians who call themselves the Baseball Project, contains titles like The Death of Big Ed Delahanty and Gratitude for Curt Flood, and demonstrates that there's still room for originality in the genre. Joining me now from NPR's New York Bureau are two of the Baseball Project's four members, Steve Wynn, who is known for his work with the Dream Syndicate and currently with Miracle 3. Steve, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks. Good to be here.
And I'm also joined by Miracle 3 drummer and singer Linda Pittman. Linda, welcome.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having us.
Steve, it's easy to glean from the lyrics of the 13 songs that you and Scott McCoy wrote for Frozen Ropes and Dying Quails that you have more than a passing interest in baseball. But how did you go about deciding which of the many stories baseball's long history offers were really worthy of being put to music?
Well, there's so many. You've got your favorite things, and Scott and I wrote about a lot of our favorite baseball moments. Now, Scott, being a guy from the Bay Area, wanted to write a song about Willie Mays. And me, being an L.A. native, I had to chime in about Sandy Koufax and Fernando Valenzuela. Mm-hmm. And so certain things were, for example, the Harvey Haddix game that I wrote about.
12 perfect innings, yeah, and he lost.
And he lost. Harvey Haddix, you know, in 1959. And this is something, you know, and couldn't believe that this guy, Harvey Haddix, had thrown a perfect game. You know, it's a 27 men you face, and you get all 27 out. No walks, no hits, no errors, no hit by pitch, nothing, nada. And he pitched this incredible game, and it was tied after 9, and he pitched to 10th inning, perfect, tied. To 11th inning, perfect, tied. And he went, like you say, 12 perfect innings, and finally gave up a hit and lost the game in the 13th. And I just thought that was, you know, I always liked that story. I mean, something kind of very romantic and tragic and sad and beautiful and everything in that. And that's, you know, what you look for as a songwriter, stories like that.
You look for the stuff that that transcends baseball.
Exactly, and that's something I really like about this record is, you know, we wanted to find songs that would work whether you like baseball or not, that would work if you love baseball, that you would enjoy the references to Rick Wise and Campy Campaneris and Harvey Haddix. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't care about baseball, you might get something from them as well about subjects like, well, the Harvey Haddix thing. You may not care about baseball, but the idea that you just do everything right perfectly, just everything's going so well, and then after hanging on to that perfection for such a long period, it's blowing it all at the last minute. That's the thing people can relate to in any field. Hopefully not too much. But I'm afraid people can.
Well, let's listen to some music now. The song sung from the point of view of Ted Williams takes off from the story of how Williams would sometimes take batting practice alone in Fenway Park. And while doing so, he would allegedly shout between pitches, "I'm Ted Bleeping Williams, and I'm the greatest bleeping hitter in baseball." Let's listen to that one.
You're going to play
included.
That?
Included, yes.
I love NPR.
What led you to go for wistful in a Ted Williams song?
You think it's wistful?
Yeah,
huh?
I do. I mean, he's
there's
saying,
a little of that going on.
What's the matter with me? They all like Willie Mays more than they like me. They like Mickey Mantle more than they like me.
I think he probably said things like that. I think Ted Williams actually really had a hard time with the fact that he knew he was the best, and yet he really wasn't that popular, even in Boston.
He just wasn't all that lovable. I mean, there are certain characters in baseball, and there are a long list of them in every era, who don't ingratiate themselves with, the masses.
And I love players like that. And I love, I'm an unabashed Barry Bonds fan. There's something about a guy who, well, let's just say is as good as he is, and we won't even discuss why he might be as good as he is. But, the player that who just... You might not love him, but you can't deny that he's really good. And Ted Williams was the same way.
Well, surely there's a song in the Barry Bonds story.
Well, there is a song about Mark McGwire on this record talks about, the whole steroids controversy and Scott takes a very personal spin on that and is kind of writing it, from a somewhat sympathetic point of view, how he's had to deal with his legacy. And basically that's been by disappearing.
Absolutely, into a gated community, as you say
exactly.
in the song.
Exactly. Yeah. You do know the record well.
The Baseball Project includes one song in Spanish. It's sung from the point of view of Fernando Valenzuela, who pitched for the Los Angeles Dodgers during the 80s and several other teams in the 90s. The lyric, translated, begins, "I did my work in Chavez Ravine, where my people lost their homes 20 years ago. Now the crowd wants me, but nobody knows what I'm saying after the game." Let's listen to a little of that song.
Yo trabajo en Chavez Ravine, donde mi gente perdieron sus casas 20 años pasados, y ahora todo el mundo me quiere, pero nadie sabe lo que yo hablo después del partido.
The song ends with what can be taken as a comment on the contemporary immigration situation. What do you have Fernando Valenzuela saying about that?
You translate the first verse really well. In the second verse, he talks about when he came up and it was a Fernando mania, but they don't care about my people when we're not playing in the American pastime. Mm-hmm. And then finally, by the end, he says, now everyone says, go back where you came from. Now what's changed? I really want to know. That song is written about three periods, approximately 1960, when Dodger Stadium came in and dislocated a lot of Mexican families from their homes to make the stadium. 1981, when the whole – and I was there at the time – when the whole city rallied. This one, amazing pitcher who had the most incredible first half. And then, then 20 years later, this almost venomous –
division.
Fear, hatred against Mexicans in California is so sad to see. And so I just looked, Fernando looking at those three things and wondering, how did this happen? How do we go from one thing to another thing and back to this other thing again?
I'm talking with Linda Pittman and Steve Wynn of The Baseball Project. You're listening to Only a Game. I failed to mention earlier that the full title of the CD, Frozen Ropes and Dying Quails, is prefaced by Volume 1, so I assume this means we can expect Volume 2 very soon.
Oh, yeah, and probably I think very soon is right. We're already writing songs for Volume 2. We talked about doing this record for a long time. Both of us had the idea to do it. We hadn't started to write the songs, just had maybe some subject matters in our head. Once we started writing it, once we got down to it, the songs wrote themselves. These stories, that are already great. You don't have to do that much. Just throw, break out, you know, the baseball encyclopedia in one hand, your rhyming dictionary in the other hand, and you're halfway off to the races.
Boy, it's easy. I'm going to have to try this.
Yeah. It's like I should credit Sammy Kahn and Bill James with the co-writes on this. And anybody, you know, people might get that. The Sammy Kahn rhyming dictionary and the Bill James baseball abstract being two things that could help you write this record. But there are so many great stories that you can just go on and on. And we, on this record, one plan we'd had from the get-go was to involve a lot of other baseball fan musicians like Ira Kaplan from Yellow Tango and Craig Finn from the Hold Steady, Stephen Malkmus, a lot of people we know who are, you know, just like us, musicians, record makers, but also love baseball. And we were going to do that, but we started writing the songs and we just were knocking them out so fast we didn't have time to involve anybody else. So I think in the future it might be even a few guest stars and pinch hitters and, you know, we can add to our fantasy league as we go along.
Well, let's go out with one more song. The refrain of Pastime is, so long, Pastime, are you past your prime? Were you playing against sentimental type there?
Well, Scott wrote that one, so I had to kind of get inside his head on that. But no, I think it's a very loving look at the game. It's like, it's still great. It's always had its idiosyncrasies and flaws, and people say it's too slow, and you know, there's good periods and bad periods, but it's still going strong.
Steve Wynn and Linda Pittman are two of the musicians responsible for the Baseball Project, along with Peter Buck and Scott McCoy, who are currently on tour with some little non-baseball band called R.E.M. They spoke to me from NPR's New York Bureau. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
At the World Snail Racing Championships in Congham, Norfolk, Great Britain, a less than entirely slow beast named Haika prevailed over some 300 disappointed competitors, unless they didn't really care. A trainer sent the snails into a veritable frenzy of motion with the command, ready, steady, slow. Haika apparently wasn't paying attention to that last bit, for he virtually bolted from the center of a circle over a well-watered course and across the finish line 13 inches away in a blistering 3 minutes, 2 seconds. For his efforts, the winning snail received a silver tankard stuffed with lettuce. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a competition featuring librarians, book carts, choreography, and the shedding of clothing. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
We have talked about steroids, human growth hormone, EPO, and blood doping in connection with various athletes, of course. A report that recently ran on German television suggests that sports writers headed for China may next have to become familiar with gene doping. Can you bring me up to date on that one?
Well, there's Gene Mock, who managed like a dope, but that's not what we're talking about here.
No, no.
Yeah, the German television had someone pose as an American swimming coach, which is interesting.
Convincing choice.
And went to a doctor who offered to give the fake American swimming coach a stem cell therapy, you know, to do essentially what blood doping does, only on a higher tech level. Look, once again, it proves the principle that I apply to all of these stories, and there are going to be more even on this very program. Science marches on. The people who are trying to prevent the scientific, biochemical, and technological improvement of the athletes will always lose because they will always play from behind.
This week, the Chinese government announced that they would establish designated protest zones during the games in Beijing. What do you suppose those will look like?
Well, I suspect they might be in Denver, but... no, this is something. Unfortunately, I wish I could completely critique the Chinese over this. This is a system that's been in place since the induction of the current president of the United States. So while it shouldn't surprise anyone that it's happening in China, which this week, by the way, pulled all the copies of the Beijing Times off the newsstands because it ran a photo of the dead and wounded in Tiananmen Square, I think this whole experience for American journalists is just going to be a barrel of laughs.
On court, Donnybrook's suspensions and the signing of an aging former superstar were in the WNBA news this week. Charlie, I guess maybe that league has finally arrived.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's become everybody's dinner on talk radio for a while, which is too bad considering the level of play that they've had there. But and for me, it's hard to me to believe that a team like Detroit, which would have Bill Laimbeer as a head coach and Rick Mahorn as an assistant coach, would be involved in something like this. Mahorn got suspended essentially for pushing Lisa Leslie to the ground in what he says is an attempt to break up the fight. It's a very bad optic for the league, number one. And number two, I don't believe a word of it. But the Nancy Lieberman thing, coming back at 50, having a couple assists, including a no-look, that's the best thing that's happened to the league, you know, in 2 weeks.
I almost can't believe that I'm saying this, but the Green Bay Packers are apparently talking with other NFL teams about finding Brett Favre a new home. Can you recall an athlete of Favre's caliber who has so thoroughly managed to screw up the end of an otherwise just exceptionally brilliant career?
Well, he doesn't reach the end of it yet, apparently. Somehow, in the city of Green Bay, Brett Favre has become bigger than the Packers, which I didn't think was possible for anyone. Every NFL team, except maybe five, could use him. Because as Charlie Weiss told me once, there are 32 first-string quarterbacking jobs in the NFL, and there aren't 32 guys who can do the job. So, yes, I think if they want to talk particularly to the Jets, who seem to be milling around the crowd, I think that's the best thing they can do. They can't bring him back because either Aaron Rodgers will wind up in the front office with, you know, road flares tied to his body, or they have to insult the biggest star they have. So I think getting rid of him as quickly as possible is probably the only alternative they have.
Since April 2007, 18 Iowa football players have been arrested. Is it time to paraphrase Satchel Paige and warn Nebraska and Florida not to look back because something might be gaining on them?
This is really something, because I've been to Iowa City and I didn't think there were 18 things you could do wrong there. But apparently there are. I think that the sports information director pointing out that, quote, the staff has worked extra hard throughout the summer setting a tone and laying out expectations kind of leaves open the question of how good a job they did doing that.
Duke University must be used to being on the receiving end of lawsuits by now. Does Andrew Giuliani, Duke student and son of the former mayor of New York, have a case against that beleaguered school?
No, he got cut because he wasn't good enough, and they were cutting the team from 13 players down to about 7 or 8. And I think the lawsuit's contention that this has somehow interfered with young Giuliani's efforts towards becoming a professional golfer, I think if you get cut from the Duke golf team, you have a lot more work to do than that which is done in the law offices and the courtrooms.
I know that there are stamps out there, Charlie, that are worth a lot of money because the airplanes pictured on them are upside down or something like that. Does that same principle apply to Super Bowl rings?
Well, it does now, that's for sure. They were auctioning off Steeler Super Bowl rings from the mid-70s on eBay, and one of the people who spotted it noticed that they had, you know, the Super Bowl IX has all three of the Super Bowl champions, that the first Super Bowl, the Steelers and the Bills, had a score that was wrong. It had it as 32-6 when it was actually 32-14. And apparently, nobody noticed. The ring company didn't notice. The Steelers didn't notice. The people wearing it didn't notice. Nobody noticed until this one guy did.
And finally, still another dandy minor league baseball promotion.
Yum food!
The prize this time is all you can eat and drink at the ballpark in Madison, Wisconsin. And I wonder if they let you do the drinking part before you have to accept the challenge the Madison Mallards presented.
Well, I have a friend from the South who calls certain things the eat a bug test.
Mm-hmm.
What can I give you that would make you eat a bug? Well, apparently, the Madison Mallards have discovered that there are people in Madison who will eat a bug for $30. And then can go to, well, actually, $30 worth of food at the all-you-can-eat-and-drink duck blind party deck. I would point out that once you've like digested the bug, you could probably get one of their previous specialties of the hotel at the Mallards Ballpark, which is the Luther Burger, named after the late Luther Vandross.
I'm not sure I want to hear about
this. Which is the single most disgusting piece of food I've ever seen. It is a bacon cheeseburger between two glazed donuts.
I don't know what to say.
Well, I'm going to sit here just for a minute and listen to my arteries harden by proxy.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. I'm hungry.
Yum.
Thanks,
food.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. Synchronized swimming, gymnastics, ice skating, and ice dancing all feature choreography, but as Only a Game's Charlie Schroeder reports from Anaheim, there's a fifth sport requiring orchestrated moves, and you'll never guess what it is.
At 3:45 on a recent Sunday afternoon, my stereotype of librarians was completely turned on its head.
Sexy? Hold on, I gotta talk to her. I'm sorry, did you just say librarians are sexy?
Oh, we are, we are. Just ask our husband and those teenagers that come to my library.
We give it away for free.
I've heard, but for 2 weeks or 3 weeks at a time, I've heard.
And you can renew whenever you'd like.
That's Tammy. I'm not going to give you her last name because, well, she's a California school librarian, and I don't want her to get fired. She's one of the California girls, a team of 8 school librarians, competing in this year's American Library Association Book Cart Drill Team Championships. That's right, Book Cart Drill Team. While Tammy and I exchange bad puns, the rest of her team apply temporary tattoos to their midriffs. You know, stuff like librarians rule and read or die. Which surprises me, but probably not the ALA's Director of Conference Services, Deirdre Ross, who organized today's competition.
It does tell people librarians are very different, not what you thought. They're lots of fun and very creative.
Ross first heard about book cart drill teams in, well, a book.
And I looked at the book and I thought, well, this is a thing, you know, and I hadn't realized that it was just a librarian thing, and most of the teams did it in parades, like the 4th of July parade or the Memorial Day parade.
The photos of librarians dancing with decorated book carts excited Ross so much, she thought a drill team competition would be a great addition to the ALA's national conference. So, 3 years ago, she tried it out.
And it was just mesmerizing because people just put their heart and soul in it, and it was just like more than I ever had expected.
At this year's conference in Anaheim, 8 teams from Delaware to California, including bibliotechies, Palm Desert cart attacks, and bibliophiles, are putting their heart and soul into it. One team I speak with from Riverside County Library West in California tells me they don't just want to push book carts back and forth between team members and do a pirouette every now and then. They want to tell a story through song about James Bond.
You'll hear parts where he's talking about his relationships with women. They end bad, so he's going to have a woman, you know, he's going to get slapped. His woman that he loves is going to get killed, and so we go by the lyrics.
That's Gilmore, Aaron Gilmore, the newest Bond. A youthful, bespectacled lad who's more Harry Potter than Roger Moore. He and his team, call number 007, get it? Call number 007? Rehearsed twice a week for 2 months for today's competition. On the other side of the curtain that separates the Anaheim Convention Center's backstage area from the audience, about 2,000 spectators gather to see just how creative librarians can get with book carts. One, Morgan Murray, tells me he hopes to see one of his fantasies become a reality.
Well, you know, there's always that image of the librarian who's got her glasses and her hair up in a bun, and then she takes the hair clip out and tosses her hair and throws the glasses off, and this pretty much is consistent with that sort of passing the image.
There's always that image?
As the competition begins, Most of the routines bring to mind vintage MGM musicals and are exactly what Morgan Murray hopes to see. At one point, I think, oh my word, it's librarians gone wild. In one routine, a woman stands atop two book carts. Then her teammates slowly pull them apart until she's suspended midair in a split. The California girls enhance their number by reaching under their shirts, pulling their bikini tops off, and throwing them high into the air. But it's team call number 007 that takes the competition to a new level, according to today's Master of Ceremonies, children's author, Mo Willems.
It's beautiful how much, you know, we had the sex, but you added the violence. My library, very little sex and violence.
There's the simulated violence, of course, but there's also accidental violence. When, mid-routine, a faux slap to James Bond's face gets a little too close for comfort.
He just lost his glasses.
A mishap that costs the team major points with the judges.
9.007 for a grand total of 007 points.
Thanks,
congratulations. 007.
In the end, though, nothing pleases a crowd, even a crowd of bookworms, like early 80s Michael Jackson, something Santa Monica Library's well-stacked librarians understand. Despite the team's name, the librarians' routine is more rated G than R. Their book carts sport biohazard signs and beakers that overflow with smoke. They're dressed like Albert Einstein, lab coat, wig, and all. But when Thriller starts playing and the librarians morph into dancing zombies, the crowd, normally known for shushing people, gets loud. Really loud. It may not be the stuff of New York Times bestsellers, but the Jackson homage wins the crowd over, and the judges.
9.95! Oh, sweet. Or as my mother would say, 0.05 from doing a good job.
When the totals are added up, the well-stacked librarians are victorious. Afterwards, I speak with the team's choreographer, Shauna Johnson, a former cheerleader turned youth services librarian.
What does it mean to win this competition?
Oh, it's amazing. This is the first thing that we've ever done. We just got together about 2 months ago. We practiced, and it's amazing that we came out where we did.
Are you going to cry? Don't cry on me. Don't cry.
I'm not.
She doesn't. Well, she does. A little. Then, a few minutes later, an elated Morgan Murray, the spectator with a librarian fantasy, pulls me aside. He was right, I tell him. Librarians really do let their hair down, to which he counters.
Every librarian wants to show off their sensuous side.
Although the well-stacked librarians prove that, at least when it comes to book carts, sex doesn't always sell. For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Anaheim, California.
But when I try in here to tell you, dear, I love you madly, madly, madam librarian, Marion, it's a long lost cause I can never win. For the civilized world accepts as unforgivable sin any talking out loud with any librarian, such as
Warren G. Harding, the president-elect, raised his left hand to take the oath of office. Then he smiled as someone gently suggested that it was his right hand he should raise, and that he should also tuck in the oil leases sticking out of his hip pocket. From the window of his hospital room in New York City, George Herman Babe Ruth waved to the fans who'd gathered in the street far below. He opened the window so that he could toss baseballs to the youngsters in the crowd. Fortunately, Wade Hoyt, a longtime pitcher with the Yankees, told the Babe it would be a stupid and dangerous thing to do. With a twinkle in his eye, Benjamin Franklin lifted a tankard of ale off the rough wooden table at his favorite tavern, the Trois Corbies, I think it was, and told a few close friends about a little experiment he'd done with a kite, a key, an electrical storm, and a French lass much given to winking. And on that day, Only a Game began. No, just funning you. But at Only a Game, we are celebrating an anniversary. On July 27th, 1993, just shortly after the miracle of radio burst upon a puzzled but grateful populace, out of the static of the old Philco came a story of Bill Lee, the former Boston Red Sox pitcher who had brought a team of ex-major leaguers to Cape Cod for a game against a group of college kids. The home team was the Falmouth Commodores. The visitors were Lee's Gray Sox. Bernie Carbo, who had once kept a stuffed gorilla in his locker at Fenway Park, was one of the latter. That was the first story we produced for Only a Game. 15 years is enough time so that some of the Falmouth Commodores featured in that story have built impressive big league careers, like Darren Erstad of the Houston Astros, and some of them have retired, but I bet Bill Lee is still playing somewhere for somebody. I'm delighted that we are, too. I would close by saying I hope that you've had as much fun with the program as I have, but I don't think that would be possible. So I'll just say thanks to WBUR for the station's exceptional support, and to my colleagues, Gary, Karen, John, Doug, and Charlie, and to all the colleagues who've come and gone, and thanks to all of you for listening. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Jim Doyle. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to learn more about the Baseball Project, view various photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our first final word is from Jessica Nitowski of the Palm Desert Cart Attacks, who explains her team's motivation.
We actually designed this routine in mind with maybe going to elementary schools and performing for the kids to instill in them we're not a bunch of shushing old bats.
On the contrary, they're bikini-tossing super vixens, but according to Drill Cart Team Championship spectator Jacqueline Jones, librarians do so much more.
Some librarians ride motorcycles as their hobby. Some horseback ride. They do many things. Puppet shows.
Puppet shows?
Another stereotype smashed on Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.